listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. For those who had doubts about the existence of a new Cold War coming into Tuesday, it was difficult by the end of the day to sustain them. Early in the day, it was announced that the Dutch foreign minister, Halbe Zijlstra, resigned after admitting that he lied about attending a meeting in 2006 at which he had said Russian President Vladimir Putin outlined a strategy of expansion to build a greater Russia. RT's Medina Kachanova has more.
The Dutch foreign minister was quite emotional when he announced his resignation. He was supported by the country's prime minister, who was also present during this announcement, and he also seemed quite moved by the situation. Now, what happened today is the result of a big scandal that erupted when it was revealed that the Dutch foreign minister lied back in 2016 about an event in his life. And at that time, when he described that event, that didn't raise that much of a lot of questions, as it happened when Russia was accused of all sorts of things. Moscow was accused of carrying out aggressive politics. So that lie fit quite well into that context. Now, back in 2016, the Dutch foreign minister said that he was present at a meeting with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, and he heard the president talking about unifying Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltic states, and Kazakhstan into one single country, creating a greater Russia.
It was begin 2006.
In early 2006, I was at Vladimir Putin's countryside house. I stopped at the back of a room where a meeting was being held, but I could hear very well Vladimir Putin talking about a greater Russia. He said this included Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, and the Baltic states. And that Kazakhstan would also be nice to have.
Well, these were his words back in 2016. But then when he was confronted about that, he acknowledged that that was a lie, that he was not even in Russia in 2006. And he was only protecting a source of his, a person that was at that meeting. And now the minister said that his credibility had been damaged by the scandal to such an extent that his position had become untenable. Now, he described the recent events as the biggest mistake in his political career, adding that the country deserves a foreign minister who is beyond any doubt. Now, all that is taking place just one day before his official meeting with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. I was about to attend this meeting, as were many other journalists, and we had questions for him prepared, of course, concerning this particular situation. But now it seems that the meeting is off the table, as it was officially declined by the Dutch side.
Meanwhile, in Washington, the three heads of the groups that have become known collectively as the intelligence community were testifying that Russia, in fact, did interfere in the 2016 election in the U.S. and planned to do so again in this year's midterms. And again, no evidence was offered, although some was referenced. That, however, is top secret. But the lack of evidence didn't stop New York Democratic Representative Gerald Nadler from not only stating that Russia interfered in last year's election as a fact, but terming it as an act of war.
This is as much an attack on the United States as if they were bombs and bullets. Mm-hmm. It's an attack on our essential governing structure.
One of Nadler's Democratic colleagues in the Senate, however, has some problems of his own. RT's Jacqueline Voga has more.
In case you haven't noticed, the Democratic Party is very worried about big bad Russia.
They found portals into our society.
The Kremlin clan.
Russia has harnessed the tremendous and, quite frankly, to me, frightening power of social media.
Truly troubling evidence of the scope and reach of Russia's interference in our last election.
And the top Democrat on the Senate's Russian investigation, Mark Warner, is no exception to the rule.
I'm concerned that the president still does not recognize the severity of the threat.
But apparently Warner does, and he will do anything necessary to battle Moscow's reach. Based on leaked text messages between the senator and a second party, it looks like when it comes to the Russian threat, the ends justifies any means, including attempting to carry out some collusion of your own. Several of the messages show Warner trying to arrange a secret meetup with Christopher Steele, the former spy behind the now infamous Trump dossier.
We want to do this right private in London. Don't want to send letter yet, because if we can't get agreement, we'd rather not have paper trail.
So who was Warner depending on to set up the clandestine meeting with Steele? That would be one Mr. Adam Waldman, a lobbyist best known for acting on behalf of the Russian tycoon Oleg Deripaska. And according to the text, Waldman is also connected to Julian Assange, another person accused of being a Kremlin puppet. Now, this was all way under the table. Warner repeatedly refused to make the invitation to speak to Steele officially in writing, while at the same time telling Waldman that the pair's efforts would be helping America. And apparently, in his mind, the way to do that is to be in cahoots with the confidant of one of the richest men in Russia. And according to Republican Senator Mark Rubio, the whole Senate Intelligence Committee has known about the context for months. So if neither the Democrats nor the Republicans care about Warner's conduct, is it just that collusion is a problem reserved for only one party? Or is the reality here that Russia is just being used in a political game of chess?
And it wasn't just Democrats that were raising the issue and basically comparing the alleged Russian meddling, stated as fact, to an act of war. Dan Coats, who is the Director of National Intelligence, appointed by President Trump himself, voiced a similar claim on Capitol Hill Tuesday.
Frankly, the United States is under attack. Under attack by entities that are using cyber to penetrate virtually every major action that takes place in the United States. From U.S. businesses to the federal government to state and local governments, the United States is threatened by cyber attacks every day.
However, in Coates' view, the threat isn't just coming from Russia, but from a variety of places around the world.
While Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea pose the greatest cyber threats, other nation states, terrorist organizations, transnational criminal organizations,
and ever more technically capable groups and individuals use cyber operations to achieve strategic and malign objectives. Some of these actors, including Russia, are likely to pursue even more aggressive cyber attacks with the intent of degrading our democratic values and weakening our alliances. Persistent and disruptive cyber operations will continue against the United States and our European allies, using elections as opportunities to undermine democracy, sow discord, and undermine our values.
It should be noted that in the context of Coates' remarks, a discussion at the Brookings Institution featured a keynote by Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy David Trachtenberg, who explained the latest nuclear posture review of the U.S. government.
Thank you very much. It is my pleasure to be here and to talk about this very critical issue, the nuclear posture review. As you all know, each post-Cold War president has, early in his first term, conducted a review of U.S. nuclear policy, posture, and programs. President Trump's first national security presidential memorandum, issued 1 week into the new administration, directed Secretary Mattis to undertake the fourth such review of U.S. nuclear policy. The aim of the review was to ensure the United States' nuclear deterrent is modern, robust, flexible, resilient, ready, and appropriately tailored to deter 21st century threats and reassure allies. The Department of Defense conducted this review, along with the Departments of State and Energy, and in consultation with allies and experts from inside and outside the government. The resulting 2018 Nuclear Posture Review establishes the Department of Defense's priority as maintaining a safe and effective nuclear arsenal that can effectively contribute to four key goals: deterring nuclear and non-nuclear attack, assuring allies and partners, achieving U.S. objectives should deterrence fail, and hedging against an uncertain future. The NPR also emphasizes that U.S. nuclear policy will continue to contribute to U.S. nuclear non-proliferation goals. Now, these roles are consistent with past priorities of U.S. nuclear policy. Indeed, the 2018 NPR maintains long-standing nuclear policies adopted by both Democratic and Republican administrations. For example, the new NPR recognizes the need for the nuclear triad and sustains the previous administration's plan for modernizing the aging U.S. nuclear triad of land-based, sea-based, and air-breathing delivery platforms, as well as its supporting nuclear infrastructure and command and control. Consistent with the 2010 NPR, conducted by the prior administration, the 2018 NPR declares that the United States would only consider using nuclear weapons in extreme circumstances to defend U.S. vital interests. In addition, the NPR also reaffirms the U.S. commitment to arms control and nonproliferation by maintaining support for the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and by sustaining the extended deterrent for allies. Extended deterrence is critical to their security and promotes nuclear nonproliferation by checking their need to acquire their own nuclear weapons. Now, each of the previous NPRs has rightly emphasized that U.S. nuclear policy must be responsive to the threat environment of its time. The 2018 NPR addresses the reality that while the Cold War has been over for decades, a much more challenging nuclear threat environment has developed since the previous 2010 nuclear posture review. This is the reality that confronted the new administration when it began its nuclear posture review. Accordingly, the 2018 NPR is grounded in a realistic assessment of the contemporary security environment, one that recognizes a return of great power competition and the increasing salience of nuclear weapons in the arsenals and doctrines of potential adversaries. For example, since 2010, the Russian leadership has made repeated explicit nuclear threats to U.S. NATO allies and others, brandishing Russian nuclear weapons in a way we really had not seen since the height of the Cold War. Russia is actively modernizing and expanding its strategic and non-strategic nuclear weapons, and doing so in continuing violation of the landmark 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty. Like Russia, China is pursuing expansionist moves at the expense of its neighbors, including key U.S. allies, and doing so also through the threat of force. China also continues to expand its nuclear capabilities in both quantity and quality. Since 2010, China has announced the development of, or fielded, new ICBMs and theater-range ballistic missiles, a new sea-launched ballistic missile, a new ballistic missile submarine, and a new strategic bomber. China's intentional lack of transparency regarding the scope and scale of its nuclear modernization serves only to magnify uncertainties about its future intent. Also, since 2010, North Korea has rapidly increased the pace of its nuclear testing and of theater, intercontinental, and submarine-launched ballistic missiles. At the same time, North Korea has repeatedly made explicit nuclear threats to the United States and our allies in the region. And while Iran's nuclear future remains uncertain, its malign activities and hegemonic aspirations in the Middle East are not. Now, in contrast to these developments over the past decade, the United States has built no new types of nuclear weapons or delivery systems, other than the F-35, for the past two decades. We have instead sustained our nuclear deterrent with life extension programs, keeping systems and platforms beyond, decades beyond, their designed service life. Former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter rightly observed that if there is an arms race underway, the United States clearly is not a participant. It is clear that our attempts to lead by example in reducing the numbers and salience of nuclear weapons in the world have not been reciprocated. Since the 2010 NPR, the prospects for great power military confrontation have expanded, while both Russia and China have increased the number and salience of their nuclear weapons programs. The intentional restraint reflected in U.S. nuclear policies did not lead the rest of the world to follow the same path. Now, this is not a unique conclusion reflected in the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review. The U.S. National Intelligence Council recognized this great difference in the U.S. and Russian approaches to nuclear weapons back in 2012, concluding, quote, "Nuclear ambitions in the U.S. and Russia over the last 20 years have evolved in opposite directions. Reducing the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. security strategy is a U.S. objective, while Russia is pursuing new concepts and capabilities for expanding the role of nuclear weapons in its security strategy," end quote. The 2018 NPR responds to this increasingly challenging threat environment not by changing long-standing tenets of U.S. nuclear policy that have bipartisan support, but by emphasizing emphasizing the maintenance of those capabilities needed to effectively deter war in the current environment. It also seeks to clarify U.S. policies to help remove the potential for mistaken calculation by potential adversaries that limited nuclear first-use threats or escalation can provide them with any possible useful political or military advantage. Correcting the potential for such calculations is now a key to maintaining deterrence of nuclear war. In this regard, I'd like to address three of the corresponding outcomes of the 2018 NPR: the clarification of our nuclear policy and the recommended supplements to U.S. deterrence capabilities, all of which have been subject to considerable news accounts and what I would consider to be considerable mischaracterizations in much of the public commentary. First, let me say the 2018 NPR returns deterrence of nuclear attack against us, our allies and partners, to the top priority of U.S. nuclear policy. Given the security environment and the changes in that environment that I have highlighted, this is a prudent, realistic, and I would argue necessary change. Second, to strengthen deterrence of nuclear and non-nuclear strategic attacks, the 2018 NPR clarifies U.S. declaratory policy regarding nuclear weapons. Doing so does not expand the circumstances for nuclear use or lower the nuclear threshold, as some commentators have suggested. Rather, while maintaining a measure of ambiguity, it provides some clarification regarding what might constitute an extreme circumstance that could lead to U.S. consideration of a possible nuclear response. This clarification enhances deterrence and raises the nuclear threshold by reducing the potential for adversary miscalculation. As potential adversary non-nuclear capabilities continue to become more and more lethal, U.S. policy must make clear that non-nuclear strategic attacks that would have catastrophic effects on the American people and our allies must also be deterred. Finally, in addition to prioritizing deterrence and adding some clarity to extreme circumstances, the 2018 NPR also recommends two nuclear programs to strengthen U.S. capabilities to deter attacks and to assure allies. First is the modification of a small number of existing submarine-launched ballistic missiles to include a low-yield option. Second is the pursuit of a nuclear sea-launched cruise missile. Despite the awesome capabilities of our existing nuclear triad, Russia's actions indicate that Moscow may hold the mistaken belief that its numerous and diverse non-strategic nuclear arsenal provides useful options for limited first-use nuclear threats or employment. We believe the two supplements to the U.S. nuclear arsenal presented in the NPR are important to help correct this misperception and convince Russia and any other potential adversary that the United States and its allies will not be coerced by the threat of limited nuclear first use. Now, the other point I would make is that neither of these capabilities, these two supplemental capabilities, is a new capability. The low-yield option for submarine-launched ballistic missiles involves a relatively minor modification to an existing warhead. And the sea-launched cruise missile is a capability that the United States possessed for decades until recently. In addition, neither of these capabilities will require underground nuclear testing, and both are compliant with all U.S. treaty obligations. These capabilities are intended to strengthen the deterrence of war and the assurance of allies, thereby helping to ensure that nuclear weapons are not employed or proliferated. We must recognize that effective deterrence is about tailoring our capabilities to a potential adversary's calculations regarding the use of nuclear force to ensure that it can never appear to be a useful option. We must assess our capabilities relative to the doctrine, exercises, statements, threats, and behavior of potential adversaries. And the capabilities recommended by the 2018 NPR are tailored to raise the threshold for nuclear use and to do so with minimal changes to the U.S. nuclear posture. We believe the policy announced in the NPR is a reasonable response to the changes in the current security environment. Now, let me be clear. The goal of the recommendations contained in the 2018 NPR is to deter war, not to fight one. Modernization of the U.S. nuclear deterrent, adoption of tailored defense strategies with flexible capabilities, and clarification on the role of nuclear weapons all send a strong deterrence message to potential adversaries while also reassuring our allies. Finally, the 2018 NPR helps ensure that our diplomats speak from a position of strength. Russia has little incentive to negotiate seriously about nuclear reductions without a robust and ongoing U.S. nuclear modernization program. Indeed, Russian leaders have said as much. And as Secretary Mattis recently testified, Russia is unlikely to give up something to gain nothing. Critics who favor eliminating U.S. systems in the face of an expansive Russian nuclear modernization effort are undermining America's greatest bargaining leverage and the prospects for future arms agreements. The 2018 Nuclear Posture Review is one of several important reinforcing U.S. national security documents meant to guide U.S. policy in an increasingly complex and challenging world. Much as we might prefer otherwise, U.S. nuclear weapons are the bedrock of American and allied security. As Colin Gray has said, nuclear weapons are a regrettable necessity in the real world. After the slaughter of two world wars, they have prevented large-scale great power conflict for more than seven decades. In an era of renewed great power competition, adversaries, allies, and the American people should know that the United States has the will and the flexible, resilient nuclear forces needed to protect the peace.
That was Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy David Trachtenberg speaking Monday at the Brookings Institution about the Trump administration's recently announced nuclear posture review. We'll have more of that, including a Q&A with Trachtenberg and a panel discussion later in this program. Meanwhile, with members of both houses of Congress saying that, in effect, an act of war has been committed against the United States by Russia, and with the Pentagon planning for just such a war, it wasn't the danger of war that was being protested by the so-called resistance, but rather military parades. BlackAgendaReport.com's senior editor Bruce Dixon has more.
Word is Donald Trump wants a giant military parade. Artillery, armored vehicles, missile launchers bigger than the North Koreans, and thousands of soldiers, sailors, and Marines marching down Pennsylvania Avenue, possibly with flyovers of his favorite Air Force plane, the mythical F-52 fighter from the Call of Duty video game. Predictably, a chorus of Democrats, along with CNN and MSNBC, panned the idea. Their reasons are all sensible enough. It would cost tens of millions to bring all those troops and hardware to the nation's capital. Furthermore, neither D.C. city streets nor the roads leading to them are designed for armored vehicles, tanks, and their carriers. But most of all, Democrats practically whine, while the U.S. is bombing six or seven countries, while it deploys drones and special forces across vast stretches of Africa and the Middle East, while it has submarines and fleets in all seven seas, with bases, troops, and hardware in over 100 countries, domestic displays of U.S. military might are kind of, well, un-American. If that's not a contradiction, and it's not the only one, the same Democrats who think a military parade on Pennsylvania Avenue is bad form, not 2 months ago voted to give Donald Trump's Pentagon even more than the obscene amount of money he asked for. The same Democrats who wore kente cloth to or boycotted the State of the Union last week because Trump called African and Caribbean nations sh**holes cannot find their voices to object to America's bombing of Yemen, Pakistan, Afghanistan, or Somalia, or the U.S. military provocations against China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, or its blockades of Eritrea and Venezuela. American military flexing, it seems, is perfectly okay, as long as it's done overseas, and preferably, though not necessarily, by a Democrat. Since Vietnam, the last war in which Americans were drafted into the army, the Pentagon's long-term strategy has been to make the nation's gargantuan military machine and its wars as distant from the public as possible. This explains why there hasn't been a march on Washington since 1968. But Donald Trump doesn't make long-term plans. He seems to want a giant, chest-thumping, our-missiles-are-bigger-than-yours military spectacle to boost his own popularity among the base that elected him. His military parade will do some of that. But it will also draw attention to the fact that America's massive war expenditures are starving schools and libraries, decimating housing and transit infrastructure, are warping what teachers teach and what students learn. At $900 million-plus apiece, every F-35 fighter is worth a small hospital. At $13 billion apiece, an aircraft carrier, without the aircraft, is worth a dozen bus factories or half a dozen water and sewer systems for a city of 200,000. Unless there's a Republican in the White House, Democrats rarely, if ever, protest against any U.S. wars. Let's see how many Democrats show up to protest Trump's military parade, if he has it. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The games have begun. The younger sister of North Korea's ruler, Kim Jong-un, has captured the attention of the media, while U.S. Vice President Mike Pence was mocked as a dud, even undiplomatic. The two Koreas are engaging each other. This makes the Washington foreign policy swamp fume. Crosstalking the Koreas, I'm joined by my guest, Brian Becker in Washington. He's the director of the Answer Coalition, as well as host of Loud and Clear, a daily news show on Radio Sputnik. And in Columbus, we have Gregory Ehlich. He is a Korea Policy Institute associate. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Brian, let me go to you here. I'm sure you saw some of the mainstream corporatist coverage of the opening of the games and the what appears to be some kind of rapprochement between the two Koreas. But I thought a lot of that coverage just really missed the point. And the what's really important here is not if the two Koreas can actually engage each other, because, well, they are, but how much is the United States willing to go along with this engagement here? Because the United States has an awful lot at stake with its presence in South Korea. And it's not only about North Korea's nuclear program. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, Peter, I believe that we're at a pivotal moment because the attempt by the South Korean government, the Moon Jae-in government, that came about as a consequence of a very popular uprising that overthrew ultimately and led to the impeachment of the last conservative government, Park Geun-hye. Moon Jae-in wants to have a rapprochement, a lessening of tensions, and possibly the beginning of real reconciliation on the Korean Peninsula between North and South Korea. This happened, has happened in the past. It happened certainly in the year 2000. Madeleine Albright was dispatched by Bill Clinton to Pyongyang. Kim Dae-jung went and met with Kim Jong-il, who is Kim Jong-un's father, then head of North Korea. But when the rapprochement was taking place at that time, it was with Washington's blessing. And as a consequence, we see right now, and this is why I consider this to be a pivotal moment, it's a test of whether or not the South Korean government, which is clearly looking over its shoulder to see how much resistance it's getting from Washington, will be able to finally take a step to emerge as a truly sovereign entity and able to carry out within Korean politics and on the Korean Peninsula its own policy. It's a shame. You certainly don't see North Korea looking over its shoulder to see whether Russia or China approves of its moves. But here you have South Korea with tens of thousands of American troops still in South Korea. And they arrived in September 1945. They're still there. North Korea doesn't have foreign troops on its soil. So that is the big test. Will South Korea be able to resist the pressure from Washington? It's the Republicans, it's the Democrats, it's the military-industrial complex, it's the CIA. None of those institutional power centers in Washington want there to be real rapprochement taking place in Korea by Koreans without the supervision of the Americans.
Gregory, weigh in on that, because you know what leeway does South Korea have to make any kind of rapprochement with the North if there's a mutual engagement and the engagement that is real, okay? I mean, I think Western viewers tend to forget is that these are the two countries that could suffer the most if there is a conflict here. They have a real vested interest to start sitting down and de-escalating what has been happening over the last few months here. So what is the leeway the South Koreans have? Gregory in Columbus, please.
You know, of course, we don't know what kind of discussions are going on behind the scenes between Trump and Moon. I imagine there's an enormous amount of pressure being applied on Moon Jae-in. However, if you look back to former President Noh Moo-hyun, who was South Korean president during the time of George W. Bush, he also was facing enormous pressure from the United States, yet he went ahead and went to Pyongyang and met Kim Jong-il, and he signed a series of economic agreements. So he was much more forthright on warming relations with North Korea than Moon Jae-in has been, who seems rather too cautious to me. So I don't know if that's his nature or if there are certain threats that are going on behind the scenes. One can only speculate. But it is in the interest of the Korean people, both North and South, that Moon Jae-in act now and take the lead on improving relations between the two Koreas and accepting the open hand from the North Koreans, regardless of what Washington says. It's the Korean people who would pay the price if Trump unleashes a war. It's North Korean people who are currently paying the price of economic destruction caused by the truly draconian sanctions.
Right.
I think it's time for South Korea to take the lead.
You know, Brian, you hear in Western media is that North Korea is trying to be a wedge between, to break away the United States and South Korea. But it's actually the United States is the wedge between North Korea and South Korea. Go ahead.
It's just amazing. I mean, Korea has been a unitary entity with a common culture for so long, for thousands of years, in fact. And here, because South Koreans want to talk to North Koreans and vice versa, that's a wedge for America, which is thousands of miles away. It shows the arrogance and the hubris, and I'd say the racism, the architectural racism of the whole paradigm, whereby South Korea does not have the right to carry out its own independent negotiations. You are right, Peter. The wedge in Korea is the United States. Korea was divided at the 38th parallel because a couple Americans who didn't know anything about Korea drew a line and they showed it to their Soviet counterparts. And the two sides agreed that there would be two zones of control in the Korean Peninsula. And then 5 years later, when Soviet troops and American troops had temporarily, for the Soviets, permanently left the Korean Peninsula, there was a war, and the war began in June 1950. It was the unsettled issue of the post-war configuration. North Korea had considered itself to be an independent anti-Japanese colonial fighting force, right. And the South Korean government was created by the Americans, and it was just the lackeys of the South of the Japanese who were put into place, and they ruled by virtue of a military dictatorship. Now we have a situation where the United States does not want to give up its control over South Korea because South Korea, one, is an important military base for the United States. It creates part of a network of bases along with the 11 American bases in Japan. It's part of the ongoing Asia pivot, so-called, that Obama announced but really has been going on for a lot longer since before then. So the United States is fearful that South Korea could become independent. That's the real issue. What does North Korea want? North Korea wants a security guarantee. They want to end the U.S.-South Korean military exercises that simulate the destruction of their country that take place twice a year. There's a possibility for a negotiated outcome here. There's one obstacle. The real obstacle to a negotiated outcome of the Korean Peninsula crisis is in Washington, D.C. It's not Pyongyang or in Seoul.
Greg, you know, part of the security architecture of South Korea is that if there is some kind of conflict, a major conflict, the entire control of the Korean military is under an American four-star general. I mean, as an expert on Korea, I mean, how does that sit with the Korean population when they know that, you know, it's going to be the United States ultimately it's going to control, determine their security future? And then you have a foe reaching out its hand. We don't know if it's real. We don't know if it's genuine. We don't know if this is just a ploy. I mean, it's a small step, optics or something. But I mean, how does South Korea feel about that? I mean, maybe at one time they needed that kind of security guarantee, but it's a very powerful, rich country. How does that play into their thinking about dealing with North Korea? Go ahead, Gregory.
Well, of course, as you mentioned, there's the agreement that in wartime, the U.S. military would take command of South Korean forces. And actually, that was supposed to have been changed multiple times in the past, and so that South Korea would have control over its own forces in wartime. But each time the deadline came, the U.S. or conservative South Korean presidents postponed it. So that just keeps getting pushed farther and farther into the future. And unfortunately, we're still stuck in the situation. I think right now it's probably making South Korean people quite nervous when you have the reckless Trump administration, who seems to be rather oblivious to the harm it could cause by launching strikes on North Korea. So I think that makes people in South Korea quite nervous. But I think the U.S. military is not in the habit of respecting the wishes of the South Korean people or even the South Korean military. Look at how the U.S. imposed the THAAD battery on South Korea without Moon Jae-in's prior approval or even his initial knowledge. It came as a surprise to him that the U.S. was imposing a THAAD battery. Or look at how the U.S. refuses to pay the enormous costs of cleaning up the environmental destruction on the military bases is closed. I don't think the South Korean people are happy at all about being vulnerable to whatever the U.S. military commands.
Yeah, well, I mean, let me go back to Brian. I mean, these THAAD anti-missile defense, I mean, it just makes South Korea a target. You know, the U.S. says what's there to protect their interests, but actually, it's not the U.S. that is targeted. Actually, this missile system is targeted against China. Again, Korea is right smack in the middle of all of this. Go ahead, Brian.
Indeed. I mean, THAAD stands for the Terminal High Altitude Area Defenses, meaning it provides an anti-missile defense, so-called, for missiles that are at high altitude. If there was a war between North and South Korea, North Korea wouldn't be sending up high-altitude missiles to hit Seoul, which is 30 miles from the DMZ. I mean, on its face, it's absurd and ridiculous. Clearly, THAAD is designed to threaten China and to threaten Russia to achieve what the Americans hope to be a first strike capability. possibility exercising military supremacy in the future by ringing China and Russia with these kind of missile defense programs that make a first strike assault possible. Here's another thing, and I think Greg is right, and it's very important that the Pentagon rushed to deploy THAAD before and during the transition between Park Geun-hye and Moon Jae-in, because they thought Moon Jae-in would be a liberal, and because the liberals and the opposition inside of South Korea didn't want it, so they just rammed it down the throat of the people of South Korea. I mean, clearly the American government, and I think this is an important point.
Hold on to that point, Brian. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the Korea Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, and now I'd like to bring in another guest, Moon Koo Kang in Cambridge. He's an assistant professor at Baruch College, City University of New York, as well as a specialist on Korea and the Asia and Asian affairs. Welcome, Professor, to the program. Sorry it was a little bit late. I'd like to ask you a very kind of general question here. We have, after this public ceremony that we had with the North Korean delegation meeting with the South, the opening up the games, it was very optically rich, we can put it that way. But after we had that optically rich experience, we have very conflicting messages coming out of Washington from the Secretary of State Tillerson, Mattis. We have Vice President Pence saying, you know, he was very brusque. I'm sure he was. That was a message that was sent intentionally. And then we have, but he said, but maybe we could talk some kind under certain conditions. We all know what those conditions are. And then we have Secretary of State Tillerson basically saying no. I mean, what is Washington saying? What kind of message is it sending to the Koreans, if any, right now? Go ahead.
Right now, I think it's a really confusing message. I mean, as you know well, you know, the White House and then the State Department and all those key decision makers repeatedly highlighted everything is on the table. But everything on the table seems to have been, on the one hand, emphasizing some, you know, military option or even regime change on the one hand. But at the same time, they repeatedly highlighted that United States is ready to talk. So still, U.S. government position in dealing with the North Korean crisis is pretty much, you know, confusing and mixed message. In terms of dealing with, you know, Kim Jong-un, kind of, you know, so-called, you know, madman, President Trump tried to deal with, you know, madman in terms of more madman kind of, you know, creating uncertainty or anxiety. But one of the critical problem of the U.S. government is moralizing international relations. Of course, North Korean regime is very horrible, and the condition there is really horrible and disastrous. But if we moralize international relations like, you know, absolutely right and absolutely wrong, such kind of approach would be not good in terms of dealing with the crisis situation.
You know, if I can go back to Gregory and Columbus, I mean, the Trump administration has said that it will apply maximum pressure on North Korea, but also engagement. I mean, I don't see any of the engagement. And when someone does engage South Koreans, they get snubbed for it. Actually, do you just think Washington was caught off foot on all of this? I mean, because we have these conflicting reactions coming out of Washington. Go ahead, Greg.
I actually don't think there are conflicting reactions coming out of Washington. Okay. So if you read very carefully the Washington Post article in which Pence was quoted on his return flight from Seoul, what he actually said was that denuclearization has to be an initial step, that North Korea has to take initial steps to denuclearization. The U.S. is open to talks, preliminary talks, during which, of course, the U.S. would lay out its demands.
Okay,
but
well,
actual negotiations.
No, Greg. Let me jump in here.
Wait, one moment.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Just one moment. That the precondition for negotiations is for North Korea to substantially denuclearize. In other words, give the United States what it wants up front before talks can real talks can even begin.
Okay, well, that's just great, Brian. I mean, the North Koreans saw what happened to Libya. They saw what happened in Iraq. I mean, why and a lot of people have speculated that's why they've gone down the nuclear road, okay? I mean, why in the world would the North Koreans give up this program and expose themselves when they're being threatened with a bloody nose you know, seven ways to Sunday. I mean, it's absurd what's coming out of Washington. They haven't thought it through, as usual. Go ahead, Brian.
Your question answers itself, in fact, and North Korea won't give up its nuclear program, and the United States knows the U.S. won't, that Korea won't give up its nuclear program. And maximum pressure, just for our audience to understand what these euphemistic terms mean, the United States is trying to create famine in North Korea. When you deprive people of trade and deprive them of food and deprive them of medicine, you're trying to create famine to weaken the government. And that's what the U.S. did to Iraq before invading Iraq. Sanctions were in place for 13 years. According to the UN's own statistics, 1 million Iraqis died because of that. And then the U.S. invaded. So sanctions and war go hand in hand, sanctions and open war. We have a situation where North Korea not only learned the lesson of Iraq, it gave up its weapons of mass destruction, or Libya, and then the countries were invaded and the leaders were executed. It also is fully aware of what happened to East Germany. It does not want to be swallowed up by a more internationally connected second half of the country. So the North Korean government is acutely aware of the imperative need for its own security. And that's all it really seeks here, is a security guarantee. I wanted to mention one thing, Peter, real quick. Lindsey Graham represents a certain sector of American public of political thinking where he said, you know, let's get the war over with, basically. Yeah. And he, you know, he plays golf with Donald Trump all the time. Let's get the war over with because all the dying will be over there. Yeah. It goes back to your earlier question. Yeah. There's kind of a gratuitous, immoral, unethical position of American policymakers. Let's have a war because only Koreans or Japanese or people from the Asia Pacific will die. That's a minority sentiment right now, but I think it's a sentiment that's playing and trying to convince the Trump administration to reverse course here. Well, I mean, to go down that road.
Well, and that's why they want to have a parade afterwards, okay? Let me go back to the professor in Cambridge. Doesn't the U.S. put itself in a very difficult situation? Because it's just really not about South Korea and its position there. It's all of the other alliances in the Pacific. And, you know, the Japanese are going to be watching. The people in Taiwan are going to be watching. The Philippines, et cetera, et cetera. Because I've always argued against these alliances because they're too complicated and your alliance partners can pull you into a conflict that you really don't want. But all of these partners are going to be looking at the U.S. If the Koreans somehow can come to some kind of agreement, the United States is going to look weak. No matter what the U.S. does, it's going to backfire on itself, okay? And that's why they continue with this very hard line, because if the perception will be if you give up on one, you will give up on all the others, because certainly Japan doesn't want to see a united Korea. Go ahead, Professor.
Right. Yeah, you pointed out great points. But what I wanted to highlight that those, you know, international dimension or regional dimension is quite closely related to domestic political dimension as well. For instance, we need to keep it in mind, for instance, in the South Korean politics for the past 70 years after the liberation, conservative group dominated Korean politics for more than 60 years.
Right.
So the thing is that those conservative groups, in a basic rallying point, is anti-communism or anti-North Korea. And then those conservative domestic groups quite closely linked with the American hardliners, you know, hardline position. So that kind of linkage between domestic political dimension, you know, conservative, you know, politics, and then alliance relationship makes it, you know, very complicated. So I expect that, you know, Moon Jae-in government will try to slow down and coordinate this, you know, international and the domestic political situation altogether. So it's a very, you know, tricky and difficult job, but I think matching the sequence and pacing of inter-Korean relationship with the alliance coordination would be critical.
Yeah. You know, Gregory, what could be next here? Because, I mean, I certainly don't know. The only thing I know about Korean culture is its food, and it's great. Okay, but is there kind of a cultural, you know, a cultural dynamic that can take on a life of its own here? I mean, taking one step and another step. What would be the next one? Because, as we said in the first part of the program, the South Koreans don't have a whole lot of leeway, but there are other things they might be able to do. What could they be? Go ahead.
To a certain extent, it's speculation, but as far as what the Korean press says, in response to Kim Yo-jong's invitation for Moon Jae-in to come to Pyongyang and meet Kim Jong-un at the earliest convenience and improve relations. He said, well, let's create the necessary conditions, and there has to be dialogue between North Korea and the United States in order for South Korean and North Korean relations to improve. So it makes it predicates it on improving U.S. relations with the U.S. Unfortunately, did not send a return letter in response to Kim Jong-un's personal letter. But what the South Korean government is talking about is, as an initial step, is to send a private a low-level envoy not connected to the government that would discuss domestic issues such as reuniting divided families and so forth as a starting point, and from there try to slowly expand the types of contacts. But it would be very low-key, and I think Moon Jae-in is still tied into the view that he's got to bring along the United States.
Kicking and dragging them to peace here.
kicking and screaming.
Well, kicking and screaming, absolutely. Brian, I'll give you the last word here. What do you think is going to happen next year? Because I don't see the U.S. backing down. They want that bloody nose. I mean, that would be the end of the peninsula as we know it. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, the American government fears that peace could break out in the Korean Peninsula, because that would, of course, upset and overturn American preeminence and dominance over the Korean Peninsula, over South Korea. The Korean people do want peace. I hope Moon Jae-in goes faster rather than slower, because the only way that America's obstinacy can be overcome is through momentum.
Okay.
If Moon Jae-in slows it down and tries to cater to the U.S., it won't work.
On that positive note here, many thanks to my guests in Washington, Columbus, and in Cambridge. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.